The Poet and His Dyslexia.
One of the mainstays in this approach to writing is teaching people how to have sympathy for themselves. And I think that that comes out of the dyslexia too, that you have such a hard time with things. You're so odd and different and weird. And you can't do the most basic things, that you don't want anyone else to feel that way.
That's poet Philip Schultz. We'll spend the hour with him today talking about his poetry, his method of teaching writing, and his dyslexia. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. Philip Schultz won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for his book about his father, Failure. Ironically, that book, published when Schultz was 63, brought him a measure of success that had eluded him throughout decades of writing verse, including 5 previous volumes of poetry. His new collection of poems, The God of Loneliness, brings together poems written across the span of those decades from 1978 through 2009. Schultz's themes center around family, especially the immigrant Jewish family he grew up in Rochester, New York. His larger-than-life father, who held the record in New York for the most failed businesses, Schultz claims, is for sure a major inspiration. But so are his grandmother, with her acerbic pronouncements on life, his uncle Jake, who dreamed big while running the projector at a local movie theater, and perhaps his best-loved character, Schultz's own guardian angel, Stein. But Schultz has a new inspiration for his writing these days, and he's expressing it for the first time not in poetry, but in memoir. It's his dyslexia, which he discovered when one of his own children was diagnosed with a learning disability. He's much engaged in writing the memoir now, entitled My Dyslexia. It'll be published by Norton Press. I sat down with Philip Schultz in his home in East Hampton, New York recently to talk about his poetry, his teaching, he's the founder of the New York-based school, The Writer's Studio, and how his dyslexia has influenced his work, for the better. Philip Schultz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, it's good to be here.
Now, this collection, The God of Loneliness, has poems over a whole range of your life. I wonder, was it kind of daunting for you in a way to put together some of your earliest poems with your latest poems? How was that process for you? Could you see the development, and did you have any anxieties about that?
The odd thing about putting together 40 years of work came afterwards when I actually had to read the book.
And why was that odd?
Well, you know, when the galleys came and I had to actually read it as a book, I had previously been worried about, you know, which were the best poems of each collection. But I had never actually sat down and read the book. And when I did read the book, and I had to, poem by poem, line by line, I encountered myself at various stages of my life. And they're very different stages. And in my case, a lot of change was occurring. And it was a very strenuous process of reading. I mean, it's like reading one's own, I won't say obituary, but certainly one's own biography that often comes out after you're finished. The story's ended.
So what were some of the things that struck you most about the changes that you had made?
Well, I was single for a long time, and there were all these love poems, all these failed love poems. And, you know, they were all about different relationships for the most part, but they were always stressing the difficulty of it, the trying to strive to recover, the recovery of it, the understanding of it. There were the family poems. It was amazing to me that I had been writing about my father's business failures from the beginning. I wasn't aware of that. When I sat down to write Failure, a whole book on the subject, I was aware that it was something I now understood and wanted to deal with. But I had been, in small ways, writing about it throughout. There were all these different stories banding together, bonding, and becoming one story. And I wasn't always sure that this was someone I'd want to spend a lot of time with now.
Your father?
No, myself, the persona that I was meeting. I my school is based on persona writing, finding an I that isn't you who writes your material. We accept it in fiction that the he or she has to really be, if it isn't a memoir, different from us, even in a memoir. But I found it to be the same case in poetry, that the Frost, the eye he would find, would tell a story, isn't the eye that would be nervous about paying his taxes or fighting with his wife. Or there's a kind of poetic eye that you invent.
So the poetic eye, or the literary eye, if you're not working poetry, say more about this. Sure, it's not your quotidian eye, but is it a deeper, more authentic? Is it different? What is it?
It comes out of an attitude that you've created toward the material, the particular material you're writing about. I once remember the first poem that pops to my mind, which is interesting to me, is a poem I wrote 25 years ago about my experience working in a welfare building in San Francisco in the 60s. It was many years, a large experience. I was trying to write a novel that I couldn't write about it, and I wrote a small poem, and I liked the poem. I'm trying to write a book out of that poem now, going back to that material. And I just didn't know how to deal with such large, vast amount of material in a poem. And then I found the persona of a clerk. I was a clerk, a filing clerk. But then I based it on one of Chekhov's stories. He wrote many stories about clerks. And that attitude and that persona helped me tell my story because it removed the narrator from me. Mm-hmm. I was someone who was this kid who was avoiding the draft. It was this, it was that, it was graduate student. But this persona let me focus on the experience of being a clerk here, and that narrowed the material by 90%. So personas, once you have Holden Caulfield or Huck Finn, first time Twain tried to write Huck Finn, he couldn't. He put it aside for, I believe it was 20 years, maybe 30. He started in his 30s, he couldn't do it, and he went back to it well into his 50s, and he wrote the whole book. And at that point, he had the persona. He told it in dialect. And the persona, not him, not a man in his late 50s, but this boy, told the story.
I wonder if you could read that poem.
Okay. My God. Here's a poem that I haven't read for a very long time. Let me remember offhand.
It's in the beginning. I know I read it. I didn't pick it out. Although
it's in the second book. So let's see. One time returned to San Francisco and the building was gone. And I asked, it was a parking lot, a parking ramp. And I asked the clerk and he said he didn't know where it went. They moved it. It was like 5 years of my life. Okay. 8 years gone and the welfare building is a parking ramp. The attendant can't recall where it went. Uptown somewhere, he thinks. But 10,000 people filled those halls and only the ocean is a carpet big enough to sweep so many under. I was a clerk who read Chekhov and knew the fate of clerks. I learned to sway down halls like a dancer and never stopped to listen. Mornings I filed dental reports and wore earplugs against the crying for crutches, steel hands, and mattresses fitted to broken backs. A Mrs. Montvale perched on my desk and swore she'd kill herself if her new dentures didn't arrive by Thanksgiving. A fatalist with rotting gums, she feared dying toothless at a feast. Near closing time, the ghosts lined up around the block, still waiting. In Central Index, I watched 100 Ferris wheels flip rainbow cards, sorting the dead from the quickly dying, and filed the electric buzz of computers into a symphony so grand it washed the curdled voices from my head. I'm glad the building's gone. Despair can't be tolerated in such numbers, and Gray's Anatomy doesn't explain how the human body breaks 100 ways each day and still finds balance. Lord of Mercy, the dead still need bus fare and salvation.
Poet Philip Schultz. He's just come out with a terrific collection of his poetry from 1978 to 2009. It's called The God of Loneliness. You know, that poem expresses or contains so many of the elements that I find over and over again in your work and that are so attractive in it. There's the real attention to very quotidian detail. There's also this deep and abiding sense of compassion, kind of honesty with oneself. I mean, you swayed down the halls without listening. But then finally, that deep sense of humanity. And it also infuses, I think, some of your more prickly poems, some of the ones about your family, like your around your Uncle Jake, of which there are quite a few, a poem about your mother. I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about your family now. Let's start with your father, since you won the Pulitzer for Failure, and that is one of my favorite poems that I've heard you read.
You mean just address who he was, or
tell us first about him, and then how the persona of the poet in you has approached your father.
Well, something's coming to mind that I haven't thought before, which is interesting. That I remember early on, as I guess I was an undergraduate, and I was seeing a therapist and trying to deal with having no money and not knowing anyone in San Francisco. And she pointed out, when I would tell her all these stories of my family, she said, "It must be hard when you're living a novel to be trying to write one." Mm-hmm. There was no distance. She was very apt there. I think he was such an epic character that he wasn't a father in any recognizable way. We never did anything together. He was always out. He was this immigrant on the make. He was a salesman selling himself and trying to make it. And he had no time to be a husband or a father. That just wasn't in his genes. It wasn't of his interest. He was desperate to make it. And he was such a large character in so many ways, not only in how I perceived him, but how others perceived him, that even his failures were epic, and they were countless. He set a record in upstate New York for business failures. My mother thought she was marrying a guy who was going to take her out of this immigrant neighborhood, her mother's house, who owned a big parking lot in the middle of Rochester, New York, upstate New York. And 2 weeks before the marriage, he got robbed, embezzled by his his bookkeeper, and had nothing, had to move into the house. She thought she was marrying someone who dressed like a dandy, who drove a big car, who suddenly had nothing, and he stayed freeloading for 20 years. In fact, the first 5 years of my life, he worked a night shift as a janitor at Kodak. Yet he had all these large businesses and all this large appetite for life. And he started a vending business. And I would go around with him, and he would put little peanut machines in pool halls. And he turned that into one of the largest vending businesses in upstate New York, and held on to it too long, too much debt, and it went bankrupt, and he died. Mm-hmm. And he left us in real debt. But he was the story that everyone always was talking about. My mother didn't know whether to hate him or love him. I mean, everyone in the family, all five brothers, were all epic. They were stories. So I didn't even know that I didn't have a father. Everyone was always caught up in one of his stories. He was a storyteller, a great storyteller. And I, for so long, was part of this story that I didn't see. I saw myself as a character in his story. And every writer, just like we're all always somehow the star of our own dreams. You have to be. Mm-hmm. Even when someone else is. It's your dream. You have to own your own story. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to try to do that. And I think writing for me was a way of trying to own my own story. And finally, at the age of 60, when I wrote this book, I wrote it about his failure, not mine. And he became a character in my book.
Failure, of course, is such a socially constructed idea. What have you ultimately come to in thinking about your father as a quote-unquote failure?
You know, it helped me put everything in perspective, and it helped me end that story. I think in the beginning, I spent a lot of time in therapy trying to understand that it was something done to us, my mother and me. It was something done to
His failure?
His failure left us in debt, yes, and penniless. And my mother, we had a little apartment. We had to move back to my grandmother's house in the worst part of town. And I had to go off and try to help her, but also make my way without going to college. And it was a shadow that it took me a long time to deal with. Isaac Babel, in one of his great stories, points out he has a character who sees his father on his knees before a mounted Cossack captain who's there's the middle of a pogrom, and the father is begging the captain to spare his store for his family. And Lionel Trilling, in a great essay, talks about what it was like for Babel to see his the agony of sons of failed fathers. And that was always meaningful to me, reading that. And I think I've always tried to... It's hard not to see yourself as one, to separate your own failures from that of a parent who fails in a large way. Mm-hmm. So the idea of failure for me was... I mean, failing in my own way, in my own life, was a luxury. Because I was always part of this larger story of failure. The day he died, I had to go around to people to borrow money from them in order to bury him.
Mm. So you say failure was a luxury for you.
My failure to talk about me, to understand, you know, I was always, the shadow, it was so great that it was hard for me to find my own shadow, my own life, to be free of his. So writing this book was a form of liberation.
So do you feel like your success has been spurred by your father's failure?
I think to come out from under it in a way, I guess you could say that, in a way to... it cast a long shadow, and it took a long time for me to realize that I have stories to tell other than that. It was a way of getting... You know, the Hemingway quote in a story called Fathers and Sons, of course. You write it in order to get rid of it.
Well, now, would you mind reading that poem?
No. Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word. To understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched. He tripped on his pant cuffs and snored loudly in movies where his weariness overcame him finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Philip Schultz about his latest poetry collection, The God of Loneliness. You can read the title poem at writersvoice.net. So we've been spending a long time on your father here.
Keeps creeping back into the story, right?
But you have a lot of other members of your family that you write wonderful poems about, some a bit disturbing, even. There's Uncle Jake. Tell us a little bit about him. He figures briefly in the poem Guardian Angel and, of course, in a lot of other poems. So I'm going to get back to that Guardian Angel, but tell us a bit about him.
Well, he was another, I mean, I'm seeing, remembering this through a boy's eyes, but another epic, he was a character. He was a stagehand at the Paramount, and he would sneak me. I would go to the back door, and he would let me see movies, so I became enamored of all of that. But it was his house. It was my grandmother's house, and my uncle was my mother's brother. And my father was staying there for free while he was creating his various businesses. And we were treated like boarders. And he paid the bill, so he told us what to do. He didn't want lights on because he didn't like a big electricity bill, so we watched television when we finally got one in the dark. And we couldn't eat in the kitchen when he was eating. But everything he did was interesting. It was a story of great immigrant strife and longing. Everything was a production. He was a big, voracious reader. When he died, I went upstairs, and there were among the shopping bags full of girly books, nudist magazines, were first editions of Ezra Pound and Yeats and Hemingway and early Hound and Horn journals, literary journals. So he was an avid reader, and it turned out he wanted to be a writer. And was jealous of the fact that I was going off to be a writer, and who knows how I was influenced by this. But he would eat, and he would read five different newspapers, and he would never look at what he was eating. And it was fascinating, this ritual of eating. So I guess I was observing this, and it was hard to want to tell my story when the story of others were so large. My mother... story is a large one, too. I mean, she was someone who was brilliant and so smart in school that her teachers came and pleaded with her father to let her remain in school. But he wanted her to go off and work and help support the family. So in 10th grade, she had to leave school. And she married the wrong man. She returned after his death to being a filing clerk at minimum wage. She died from Alzheimer's, but didn't have anything. So to go back to the idea of failure, I refer to it somewhere as the great American taboo, the understory, the story that the part of the American immigrant experience we don't want to think about, that for every one who became successful, there were hundreds if not thousands who didn't. It's like Darwin's theory of that a species overpopulates in order for a small number of its kind to survive and adapt. And that was, my family was part of that adaption process. They were striving to survive, and most of them weren't doing it. And I felt I was seeing the story being told, which, of course, I didn't understand at the time. It took me many years. My father's story, my uncle's story, who wanted to be a writer, who, the secret of Wednesday mornings with another uncle who was institutionalized from the age of 13 on, my mother's story. So these were large characters. I was interested in being a novelist, not a poet. This is material for Philip Roth and Melamud and Bellow, not Frost. But my lot was finally to be a poet, and I dedicated myself, I guess, to telling these stories.
We're speaking with poet Philip Schultz about his latest collection of poems. It's called The God of Loneliness. And you wanted to be a novelist, but you chose poetry. Was that a conscious decision? Was there a point at which you just said, I don't have it in me to be a novelist? Or you said, poetry is the best way for me to express what I want to?
The poems I wrote got taken in my 20s by places like the Partisan Review and the New Yorker. And my fiction didn't. And I worked on novels because I felt this was an epic story I had to tell. Mm-hmm. And they didn't work. Because of all kinds of reasons that I'm dealing with now in this book I'm writing, a prose book, I probably based to some degree on my dyslexia. It was very hard for me to find a persona narrator distant enough from this big story to understand it well enough to tell it. But what I did naturally in my poetry, which was create characters who could tell the story, you know, in a much more focused way, I couldn't do in fiction. So after a while, there was success in one thing and not the other, and the poetry just took over.
Now, you mentioned dyslexia. Are there ways in which your dyslexia has added to your work as a poet?
It's very perceptive. In writing this book, I've discovered that my life is very different from the one I thought I was leading. Dyslexia plays an enormous part in ways that I didn't know until I was 58 that I was dyslexic, when my son in second grade, my oldest son, was diagnosed with it. And then I realized that every symptom he had, I had. And he got it from me.
How could you not know?
Well, I knew that I couldn't learn how to read, that I was kept back twice and asked to leave one school, that I was almost 12 when I in the fifth grade, and which I had been repeated in the third grade. I repeated, so I knew that I had everything that would lead to the fact that I couldn't learn how to read, that I'm terrible with languages, that I always thought that I've had a very curious relationship with answering machines my entire life. I never met one who could record a number correctly, and I would throw them across rooms and become furious with them. Of course, it was the way I was hearing the numbers. I've even asked people, my friends, why they didn't leave me their correct phone number that they... I didn't know until I put it all together. I didn't know that I was dyslexic. I thought that I was, as a kid, I was placed in what they called the dummy class. I was a non-learner. I couldn't learn anything, math, anything. So I just grew up seeing myself as dumb. So when I realized, suddenly I was a poster child for dyslexia organizations, a very good one in Connecticut called the Smart Kids. And I'm asked to give commencement speeches to Churchill School, a dyslexia high school in New York. And an editor heard one of these, read one of these, and asked me to write this book. And in writing the book, I've discovered that my teaching method, my school, the writer studio, persona writing, all comes out of this.
And let's not forget how the dyslexia has, in fact, enriched your poetry.
Yes. Well, you know, I went to this event, this large event in Connecticut this last, I believe it was January, and there was a young girl was getting this award. She had won a major science award from NASA, and she said that her dyslexia was her secret weapon, that she realized that it was her advantage to be dyslexic over all the other kids who were the finalists who were trying to win the prize. And she used it, that her way of thinking, that her way her brain worked, the way she had learned to go with the flow, was a big advantage in winning it. And
poet Philip Schultz. He's just come out with The God of Loneliness, a poetry collection spanning 1978 to 2009. Schultz won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry and is a founder of the Writer Studio, a school for fiction and poetry based in New York City. We'll talk more after a break.
Blackbirds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with poet Philip Schultz. before the break, Schultz started talking about his dyslexia and about a new book he's writing, a nonfiction book, about it. It's called My Dyslexia.
Since your brain is wired differently from other people's brain, and it doesn't want to do and can't do many of the things you ask it to do, you learn to do things instead of the things that you're supposed to be doing. It's compensatory thinking. You can't do this, so you do this. You can't go here, so you go here. You can't read a map. You can't follow a recipe. You can't learn a language.
So give us an example of what you did in compensation.
I remember trying to teach myself how to read and being sick and tired of feeling so poorly of myself. So I actually created a persona who wasn't me, of a boy who could actually read. I've discovered this in writing. I remember lying in this tiny little room, this bed, creating this kid who could read, who would go on to be a writer, who would go on to read successfully, and then using that persona at school or while I was struggling to read comic books, and one day it worked. I fooled myself into finding a way of teaching myself. They didn't know what dyslexia was then. They weren't able to give you any special services. They had no theories with which to teach someone how to read. So I taught myself. The tutor I had really wasn't working. He thought it was funny when I said I wanted to be a writer. I did everything in a roundabout way, teaching in an academic situation. Because I had my own method that I wanted to teach didn't really work, so I created my own school. It was based on the way I taught myself how to read and the way I taught myself how to write.
If you could distill it down, what are some of the guiding principles of the approach that you take?
Persona writing, creating...
And why does that overcome the barrier of dyslexia?
Because the story of dyslexia is a story of anxiety. That when you ask yourself to conform and live in the real world and society, your brain balks at it. It creates an enormous amount of anxiety, and that can lead to depression. Mm-hmm. And what I did, what saved me, was creating this image of someone who was more normal, who could do these things. However well I could ever conform or do these things, I did find a way of, in a roundabout way, of doing them at least adequately. And then finally, when as an adult, I decided to go off in my own direction, teach my own method of writing, have my own school, create personas, create an I who could tell my stories, my poems. I couldn't create the kind of eyes and personas that these other novelists could, but I created. So what I do now, the book that won the Pulitzer, really it was for a long poem, and half the book is called The Wandering Wingless. It's a novel. All that work writing many novels taught me how to tell a long story. So that's, I use that. It's my novel now is comes in the form of verse, and but takes on larger stories.
Now, verse captures a very particular part of the brain. People who do have learning disabilities often are able to learn and to memorize through rhyme, for example. So I wonder if you see a kind of connection there, that the very nature of verse itself capacitates parts of the brain that may not be by the straight, linear, sequential form of thinking that prose is.
You know, one of the struggles I've had in this book, that it's a personal story, it's not science. I have read a number of books on it, and I do know something about dyslexia. An expert would answer that question much better than I could. So any answer I would attempt would be through my own experience. So I don't really know, though, but I'm giving that little caveat. For some reason, and I don't know the answer to that, compression works for me. Because my brain is often all over the place and I process things so slowly. If I go to a toll booth and my wife wants me to ask the toll booth person directions, by the time I hear them, I'm past the exit. I'm supposed to turn off. we have a GPS, and if my wife doesn't sit there next to me saying, left, this left, I don't know my right from my left. Mm-hmm. Today, I picked up my son at tennis, and he was trying to tell me that his tennis instructor had bought him an ice cream, and that he wanted me to pay the guy for buying an ice cream. I didn't hear any of that. I thought that I was being asked to pay for the tennis lessons. I was in the car with him halfway home before I understood that he was telling me not to pay for several lessons, but a ice cream that the guy had paid out of his own pocket. And I just didn't hear it. And I laughed. I even said to him, and he's 10 years old, I wonder to myself, how many things do I not hear? I mean, I see how my son struggles with it. It's something that affects you in every aspect of your life. I'm sure my writing poetry, neurologically, there's an explanation, which I'm not sure I understand.
You know, some say that learning disabilities, ADD, some say that actually these engage the right brain kind of thinking, which is more creative, that you don't pick up on the details, but are better able to make imaginative leaps.
Yes, I mean, I would imagine, is therefore the right brain, certainly novelists, it wouldn't explain the difference between poetry and fiction, because the novelists, of course, use their right brain.
Well, yes, but poetry really makes imaginative leaps in a way that even a novel doesn't, that in the sense of, there, as you said, there's the compression, there's the use of the image that bypasses a whole lot of words to go to the heart of the matter.
You know, I have a book in here, it's called Living in the Past, and it's 81 poems, a family about the immigrant experience. And it was really taken directly from a novel, a 300-page novel that I was working on forever. And even though the 300 pages was boiled down from 600 pages, I could never make it work. But when I boiled them down to short little vignettes and poems and things, they're full of leaps. I could do it that way.
Could you read us?
Sure.
Read us a poem from that. And this is part of this anthology,
yes.
Philip Schulze, that we are talking about, The God of Loneliness. Selected poems, old and new.
Well, we'll get Grandma into the works. Grandma climbs a chair to yell at God for killing her only husband, whose only crime was forgetting where he put things. Finally, God misplaced him. Everyone in this house is a razor, a police radio, a bulging vein. It's too late for any of us, Grandma says to the ceiling. She believes we are chosen to be disgraced and perplexed. She squints at anyone who treats her like a customer, including the toilet mirror, and twists her mouth into a deadly scheme. Late at night, I run at the mirror until I disappear. The day is over before it begins, Grandma says, jerking the shade down over its once rosy eye. She keeps her husband's teeth in a matchbox, in perfumed paraffin. His skullcap, his silk skullcap, with its orthodox stains, in the icebox behind Uncle's Jell-O aquarium of floating lowlifes. I know what Mrs. Einhorn said, Mrs. Idle told Mr. Cook about us. God save us from having one shirt, one eye, one child. I know in order to survive. Grandma throws her shawl of exuberant birds over her bony shoulders and ladles up yet another chicken thigh out of the steaming broth of the infinite night sky. I guess it does go from one image to another.
Yeah. She's this character that seems filled with bitterness. She seems to play that role. That's her voice.
No, it's interesting to me because she's in many ways the main character, and she embodies all these immigrant beliefs and superstitions and resentments and feuds and right. And I can't tell you. My wife said she would hear me laughing back here and knowing that I was writing well, and none of this ever happened when I was working in the fiction or the prose. It was always arduous. But it all came together, and she came alive for me. And I was just, you know, wrote a sequence of poems about her in there.
Right. Now then, there's this other character, which is your guardian angel.
Stein.
Yeah. Who is he? And you also wrote a book about him.
I have a collection. It's mostly then was the person. It was a chapbook, and they had an idea that I should collect the Stein poems. And I've now gone on, and I've written others. The Israeli, now a poet, great poet, Yehuda Amichai, believed he was Stein, and I dedicated the book to him. He tried. I actually even have a little painting there that someone did of Stein. I feared after a while that he was kind of a comic character and a comic relief, and he was going to eat up all my material. But the story was so demanding that I was telling, and I thought too dark, that I needed to make up a character who, you know, this flatulent, sardines-eating, bald, somewhat defrocked, failed angel who was sent to my house to help me very begrudgingly. It was a kind of demotion. And I've had great fun with him.
So what part of your persona does he fit into?
Well, that's interesting. I think he probably comes out of wanting to be saved, wishing, you know, probably wishing I had a father who cared or someone who would notice me. I felt very, you know, dyslexia isolates people. It gives them peculiar habits and make noises and sounds, and it isolates people. And as an only child in this world, I felt invisible. So I probably came up with Stein as I had imaginary friends as a kid, and he became one of them when I was older. And he just crept into a poem, and I liked him, and people asked me about him, and I kind of like imagined him and created other stories about him.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet Philip Schultz. He's the director of the Writer's Studio in New York and is just out with a new collection of poems, The God of Loneliness. He's also working on a memoir, My Dyslexia. Now, I think I mentioned before that a very powerful theme in your work is, at least that's what I called it. I know I watched your face when I said the word compassion, and it seemed like it took you aback a bit, and yet to me it's so palpable.
Oh, no, I think it's, you know, it's so interesting in writing this book. One of the mainstays in this approach to writing is teaching people how to have sympathy for themselves, how to turn themselves into characters or find narrators who are least bit sympathetic for them, for the boy they're writing about, the girl they're writing about, the character they're writing about. Most people don't have much sympathy or understanding of themselves or others. And I think that comes out of the dyslexia too, that you go through, you have such a hard time with things. You're so odd and different and weird. And you can't do the most basic things, that you don't want anyone else to feel that way. You become very conscious and sensitive to making sure you're not making anyone feel that way, or feeling aligned, identifying with them when they are. The line that you picked up on in the welfare thing, they taught me as a way of surviving to ignore what was going on around me, or I would, most of the social workers went out drinking every single night. You can't be around all that and absorb it. So I was taught to avoid it, just not notice it. And of course, it was very hard for me to do that. It was very hard for me to do it. It was very painful to see the degree of suffering.
It's dehumanizing.
Yes.
Of oneself, not just of others.
I couldn't stand it, and it was a real struggle. I needed, it was the only job I could find because of my draft status. I couldn't get a real job, and I mean, it was a clerk's job, but I got benefits, and someone I knew in college was the personnel manager and met me in a supermarket and gave me the job. So it was just luck. So, of course, I couldn't give it up, but it was very hard for me. So, yes, there is. Thank you for noticing that. It's so much easier to write without sympathy and to make people objectify them into flashpoints of your own resentments. And I mean, I have all of that too. But when I finally write, I try to overcome that.
Mm. There's also a sense of benediction, I think, in your poetry. Kind of, there's compassion, and from the compassion comes a sense of blessing, which also is very striking. There's a sense of the preciousness of life.
Thank you.
Out of the disappointments, the multiple failures, the bitterness that you mine in your family life, there's also the sense of preciousness. One poem called The Magic Kingdom, if you wouldn't mind reading that.
Sure.
And that takes place where we are here in this region. It takes place on the beach. It's just a beautiful sense of celebration.
This is, I have to say, one of the most interesting interviews I've ever had. These are very thought out and very good questions. It's what, 140?
149.
The Magic Kingdom. It's a beautiful January Sunday morning, the first morning of the new year, and my old dogs limp behind me up the beach as my sons scour the ochre sand like archivists seeking the day's quota of mystery. To them, it's all a magical kingdom, their minds tiny oceans of good and evil strategies, the hard traffic of dreams enclosed by a flourishing expectation. We came here for the ripening light, the silence of the enormous sky, to exult in the shy jewels of sea glass polished by the tides of the wind, in the forlorn shrieks and chortling cries of gulls rising and falling between their world and ours, to be where it was lush, lonely, and secret enough. At the edge of things, in the shimmering spray and flawless sparkle of seashells, under the lonely momentum of clouds, lugging their mysterious cargoes all the way to the horizon and back, each a wish, a gift that must be returned. I never thought I'd have so much to give up, that the view from this side of my life would be so precious. Bless these filaments of seagrass, this chorus of piping plovers and bickering wrens, each mile these arthritic animals tag behind, sniffing tire ruts, frothy craters of rotting driftwood, lacy seaweed and scuttling crabs after something deliciously foul. Bless the plenitude of the suffering mind, its endless parade of disgrace and spider's web of fear, the hunger of the soul that expects to be despised and cast out, the unforgiving ghosts I visit late at night when only God is awake. Bless this ice-glazed garden of bleached stones strewn like tiny pieces of moonlight in sand puddles, the wind's grievous sigh, the singing light, the salt, the salt. Most of all, bless these boys shivering in the chill light, their fragile smallness and strange intransigence, so curious and shining. Bless their believing happiness will make them happy, that the ocean is magical, a kingdom where we go to be human and grateful.
Mm, that's just lovely. Yet with all this benediction, you say in another poem that if you have to believe in something, you believe in despair. Could you reconcile the blessing with the despair?
Well, I guess everything comes out of dyslexia. I think it's like a secret weapon. If you live in despair and know it and you're locked into it, you can choose to live in opposition to it by almost seeing it as a blessing. It's like the Bible, seeing things in opposition to that despair is a frame of mind. It can be a way of life if you're living in Haiti today and you're living in those conditions. You can give in to them and cease to exist or feel sorry for yourself, or you can strive and can find strength in the fact that things are harder for you will be a strength. Mm-hmm. Failure is a strength. So I think it comes out of that way of surviving.
It's a choice that you can make.
I see it as a choice. I really didn't know how long I was going to survive. I was on my own, no family support, no money, and everything, and dyslexic, and everything emotionally was a struggle. So I had to find a kind of inner resource, a way of getting through. I had my mother was someone who was just getting by and needed more help than could give it. So I was inventing myself as someone who was out there who was going to be a writer and make it. It took me a lot longer than I thought it would, but it happened.
We're talking with Philip Schultz about his latest poetry collection, The God of Loneliness. We're here in East Hampton, New York. I've been coming here since 1962, I believe. I've seen a lot of changes over the last 10 years, a real demographic change. You have a poem which I loved.
Summer People.
Summer People, that's right. I wonder if you could kind of set us up, talk about that, talk about Santos. Why did you write this poem, and then could you read it?
Well, the happy news is that he's now back in the fold and working for us and happy, and it was all imagined that he was angry. But, you know, you drive past the railroad station, and I think they're back. You see all these people from up island who can't find jobs and will work for anything from $10 to $20 an hour, and they're just waiting, you know, to be guys in pickups drive there and take them home, and they do the yard work and the work we won't do. And I have a great sympathy and affection for them. I came from people who once lived in their shoes, played that role, did, you know, janitors and stagehands, and so I know it. It's a way, a stepping stone. This country, if it's great at all, and I think it is in many ways, it's because of the contribution of various waves of immigrants. And these people are going to have added a great deal and will. And I wrote this poem at a time when there was a story where up island, a young from Ecuador was killed, was beaten to death and killed by racists. And as being a Jew, I know something about persecution, and I grew up around it. So I wanted to write about it, but I wanted to write about it. You know, you don't preach to the converted. You don't tell people what you don't try to convince those who don't see it that way or are too locked in their own ignorance to. And you don't tell people like you what you already know. So the idea is, how could I write a poem where just give some facts and tell pieces of the story and let the reader put it all together? And maybe try in a few instances to add a perspective that maybe is a little new, mm-hmm. or at least new for me. So that was the strategy behind The Summer People. Santos, a strong, friendly man who built my wife's sculpture studio, fixed everything I couldn't, looked angry in town last week. Then he stopped coming. We wondered if we paid him enough, if he envied us. Once he came over late to help me catch a bat with a newspaper and trash basket. He liked that I laughed at how scared I got. We're year-rounds, what the locals call summer people who live here full-time. Always in a hurry, the summer people honk a lot, own bigger cars and houses. Once I beat a guy in a pickup to a parking space, our summer sport. Lousy New Yorker, he cried. Every day now, men from Guatemala, Ecuador, and Mexico line up at the railroad station. They know that they're despised, that no one likes having to share the rewards or being made to feel spiteful. When my Uncle Joe showed me the shotgun he kept near the cash register to scare the black migrants who bought his overpriced beer and cold cuts in his grocery outside of Rochester, New York, his eyes blazed like emerald suns. it's impossible to forget his eyes. At parties, the summer people who moved here after 9/11 talk about all the things they had to give up. It's beautiful here, they say, but everything is tentative and strange, as if the beauty isn't theirs to enjoy. When I'm tired, my father's accent scrapes my tongue like a scythe. He never cut our grass or knew what grade I was in. He worked days, nights, and weekends, but failed anyway. Late at night, when he was too tired to sleep, he'd stare out the window so powerfully the world inside and outside our house would disappear. In Guatemala, after working all day, Santos studied to be an architect. He suffered big dreams, his wife said. My wife's studio is magnificent. We'd hear him up there in the dark, hammering and singing as if he were the happiest man alive.
Mm. Philip Schultz, thanks so much for spending this hour with us here on Writer's Voice. Your latest book, the collection of poems over four decades, is The God of Loneliness, Selected and New Poems.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Poet Philip Schultz. Let's listen to Schultz reading from his new collection, The God of Loneliness, at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor, New York. The event took place in April 2010.
This poem, the opening, is for Bill King and Connie Fox. Everyone arrives later than everyone else, taller than expected. The gossip, anthropological in nature, turning clockwise. Stubborn, the art doesn't seem to mind being the center of its own attention. Death remains in fashion while delight appears to be making a comeback. Art, the conversation claims, is an assault on time, a currency of doubt and opportunity, a ceasefire with calamity. Uninvited, it keeps on coming, its mouth filled with intuition, such lovely feathers. Ah, the white fluorescent walls, the landscapes grateful to have survived their own stillness. Everyone seems to want something, dogma, truth, a context. Politics is not out of the question, but passion twists the ephemeral into perception, urges the phenomenal to confront the merely mysterious. You know what I mean. All that endless standing, stepping back, squinting, sighing, doing and undoing, the middle torn out of its own beginning. The pleading to be finished, finally, the fiery binge and hoist of the impossible, ingested, flattened to nothing. The honed figure walking out the door, alone under the night's vast umbrella, the hat complaining to the rectangle about its lack of grammar, the hilarious despair of the square, the aluminum shiver longing for the simplicity of the lowly nut and bolt, canvas stretched across infinity, the disappointment's unbearable happiness beckoning for the feast to begin.
Philip Schultz reading from The God of Loneliness at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in April 2010. Thanks to Tony Ernst of WPKN for that recording. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.